So we're going to be talking about the last of the catecholamines today, and then we'll talk about the rest of the biogenic amines next week, and then, of course, a week from Tuesday, we will be on to the exam. So our catecholamine for today is norepinephrine, or if we actually spoke English in America, it would be noradrenaline. We don't. We speak American. So norepinephrine. Now, most people, when you ask them where does norepinephrine in the central nervous system come from, what would be the answer be? The locus coeruleus. That answer would be, half correct. Most of the norepinephrine for the forebrain does come from the locus coeruleus. Also projects up to the cerebellum, of course, too, but throughout the entire cortical mantle. But there's another important noradrenergic system located in close proximity to that, within the reticular system, and that is the adrenergic reticular nuclei. Anyone know the origin of the name for the reticular system? It looks like a fishnet to people that have sniffed too much formaldehyde. Small clumps of neurons interconnected strongly with one another, and then projecting out long distances as well. And the major role for these other adrenergic nuclei, which are labeled A1 through A9, is regulation of the autonomic nervous system, particularly through projections to the hypothalamus, but also down to the premotor neurons that then project out to the sympathetic chain ganglia. So locus coeruleus is not the only source of norepinephrine in the central nervous system. Additionally, there are intrinsic neurons within most forebrain structures that also release norepinephrine. And those are not directly dependent upon those brainstem and midbrain structures for the release of norepinephrine. So it's a much more complex story than just saying locus coeruleus. Okay. And since we have a test coming up, you might get questions related to how you could modulate transmission using norepinephrine. We've talked about ways, when we looked at the biosynthesis of catecholamines last time, that you could alter synthetic pathways. Things that would interfere with things like tyrosine hydroxylase, or perhaps the enzyme that's no longer called DDC, but AAADC. And then we also talked about false transmitters. Recall false transmitters from Tuesday? Okay. Obviously, you can interfere with vesicular storage. And if you interfere with storage, then you can interfere with release. And we'll be looking at things that can interfere with storage and release today. Then, of course, we have receptor-mediated effects. Agonist and antagonist for all the different types of receptors. As we're going to see, the receptors for norepinephrine can be a pretty complicated story. Who votes for having to learn the very most complicated of the stories, though? Nobody. Okay, so we're going to do the simplified version of the story. And I think that'll be sufficient for you for now. But again, show of hands, who wants to go to medical school or dental school? Figure in the future, you're going to have to learn the more complicated story. And you'll see why in a few minutes. You'll also see why I think I'm going to have mercy on you right now, and we will just stick to the simpler story. But again, pardon?
If you learn the simpler one, it'll be something to build upon.
It'll be something to build upon, that's correct. And if you can't learn the simpler one, that's probably a clue you shouldn't try to go to medical school. Okay. We're going to be talking, of course, about agonists and antagonists and suicide antagonists. We will talk about things that interfere with reuptake out of the synapse, and also things that interfere with degradation. Anybody remember two important enzymes for degradation? MAO and COMT, catechol-O-methyltransferase. MAO for monoamine oxidase. Now, what do we do clinically relevant to norepinephrine as a neurotransmitter? Are there any uses for it? A huge variety of uses. Okay, for regulation of cardiac function. Don't survive very long without a functioning heart and a well-regulated heart. For regulating blood pressure, so an awful lot of antihypertensive treatments, and in fact, sometimes hypotensive treatments to try to raise blood pressure. For bronchial dilation, I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but there's probably quite a few people that suffer from asthma. If you live in the Dallas area, which has particularly bad particulate and exposure to other volatile agents in the air. For treatment of ADHD or ADD, number of different agents. For treatment of obsessive compulsive disorder. We've already talked about the idea of antidepressants, and we'll look at some more antidepressants today as well. And then another category, decongestants. So try to keep your nose from being real runny. And of course, there are the non-clinically approved uses. We've talked about amphetamine-like effects previously. It's a little cross-reactivity for the amphetamines, but more for some of the things that are similar to amphetamines, but not technically amphetamines themselves. And in fact, we'll be talking about some drugs that have hallucinogenic properties today. Not the sort of things you're going to get a prescription for. So let's talk a little bit first about drugs that interfere with release of norepinephrine. And these are particularly clinically relevant to modulate autonomic nervous system function. Which branch of the autonomic nervous system would we be talking about? Sympathetic nervous system. Okay. Everybody should be familiar by now that you have preganglionic neurons and then ganglionic neurons within the sympathetic nervous system. Ganglionic neurons are the motor neurons. And the major transmitter that they release is norepinephrine. Some of them instead release dopamine or various other signals, but most release norepinephrine. These three drugs here, guanethidine, guanadril, and at least these two have the same prefix, guan. Sounds like something coming from a bat's rear end. Guanadril and guanethidine. This one doesn't, though. Britillium. Okay, are used to interfere with norepinephrine release. They block the magnesium ATPase that's required for pumping protons into the vesicles that is necessary for the norepinephrine vesicular transporter to function. So by blocking these specific proton pumps that are a magnesium-dependent ATPase, and that's fairly specific to norepinephrine neurons, they prevent the packaging of norepinephrine up into vesicles and hence prevent its calcium-dependent release. So they reduce sympathetic nervous system tone. Reduce the amount of norepinephrine released in the sympathetic nervous system. So guanethidine, Guanadril, and Britillium, all widely used clinically. Okay. Now the next chart, again, don't panic when you look at it, but I want to point out right away, one of our Your class members pointed out an error to me, and I did some additional research and found the older literature I had referred to, and then found that it has been completely superseded by newer literature. That was with regard to one drug that I had listed last time, duloxetine, which is marketed as Cymbalta, which I had listed as a dopamine transporter blocker. All the initial literature said that was true, and in fact, still being reported down at Southwestern as recently as 2 years ago. That's incorrect. So we're going to concentrate for today on drugs that act upon norepinephrine transporters, and it turns out that it is relevant to that. So again, we had the drugs at the top that affected all of these biogenic amine transporters, but we're going to be concentrating on norepinephrine. So indatrolene and cocaine are still there, and again, you're still not going to get a prescription for cocaine. Bupropion, or Wellbutrin, which was also used for treatment of nicotine addiction, is also used as an antidepressant because it has cross-reactivity for both the dopamine and norepinephrine transporters. Then we have a new category that we hadn't talked about previously, the drugs that affect both norepinephrine and serotonin transporters. And two of these that I've got listed here are widely marketed as antidepressants. First is vinlafaxine. Sounds like you're laughing in the middle of it. Vinlafaxine. And then the second one, duloxetine. There are other drugs in that same category, but they're typically not marketed as antidepressants, but instead as anxiolytic compounds. Everyone familiar with the term anxiolytic?
Yes.
What would that do?
Anxiety.
Relieve anxiety. Okay. And clomipramine is very widely marketed for that purpose these days. Clomipramine. This is not an all-inclusive list, but if you learn these, that's probably more than sufficient. Then we have the drugs that are regarded to be fairly specific just for norepinephrine transporters, the NET blockers, or norepinephrine transporter blockers. A couple of them are marketed as antidepressants. One is considered one of the newer generation, Reboxetine, and in fact, if you knew its brand name, Norbox, Nor gives you some kind of indication which of the transporters it was targeted at. But Reboxetine is the proper generic name. The other drug listed here in blue, Atomexetine, is also a newer drug, but it's typically not targeted for depression or anxiety, but instead for ADHD. In fact, appears to be beneficial to people that do not respond well to the amphetamine-like treatments. Adderall, various other compounds that we talked about last time. Atomexetine is marketed as Strattera, if you're interested in that. And the last one that I've got in red here, amitriptyline, is a member of a much older category of drugs, but they're still widely used. And those are called the tricyclic antidepressants. Tricyclic because they've got this triple ring compound structure. And they were among the first psychiatric drugs that were not neuroleptic drugs that reached the market. Tricyclic antidepressants. They're still quite effective for some patients, but the unfortunate reality that psychiatrists have as a little known secret is that no antidepressant works for every single patient. that some patients no antidepressants work for. Hence the large number of drugs that you unfortunately need to learn. Okay. So is that clear that there are some drugs that affect all of them? Some that affect the catecholamines, some that affect norepinephrine and serotonin, and then some that are more specific just for norepinephrine. And again, this list could be 10 pages long and still not run out of drugs. These are the ones that are most widely used, though.
How relevant is the placebo effect when it comes to antidepressants?
Very. The whole issue of antidepressants is very complex. Typically, when someone is put on an antidepressant drug, the levels of the drug hit their peak within just a few days. And they're at a steady state dose for those after those first few days. But the beneficial effects in terms of relieving the depression typically takes weeks to occur, if it's going to occur. And it's dose dependent. So sometimes the psychiatrist may have gotten the dose wrong. So if the patient comes back in 6 weeks and they're still depressed, then the typical routine is to up the dose. And if they're a bad psychiatrist, 6 weeks later, they'll continue trying to up the dose. Typically after 12 weeks and there's still no response, they'll change the patient to a different drug. So we still don't know why it takes that extra month and more for the antidepressant effect to develop. Certainly the placebo effect, if it was going to be occurring, should happen much more rapidly. But it turns out placebo effect is a very real and strong one in treatment of depression. So it's a really complex question. It's a good question. We don't have a good answer for it. All right, those blocked reuptake. How about things that block degradation? Everyone remembers MAOs and COMT. So if we have an I after that, that means it's an inhibitor. MAO inhibitors and COMT inhibitors. Now again, don't panic as you try to scribble all this down. Let's break it down where it makes a little bit of sense first. Okay, let's start with MAOs. Turns out there are different flavors of MAO. Different varieties of MAO that are called MAOA and MAOB. MAOAs are very specific for breaking down norepinephrine and serotonin. Norepinephrine and serotonin. So it's not like they're catecholamine specific because they also break down that indolamine, serotonin. MAOBs are specific for breaking down dopamine and histamine. And here's where I'm going to teach you a mnemonic trick, but it's a tricky trick. MAOBs affect the monoamines that have A in their name, in their abbreviation, dopamine and histamine. MAOAs don't. Maybe that will help you remember that. But if you remember A for A's, you'll get it wrong. It's MAOBs for A's. So if you want an A on the next exam, that's the one you'll remember. Yes. No. No, that would be a good one, but no. So we have some drugs that are specific as blockers for MAOAs, some that are specific as blockers for MAOBs, and some that are more promiscuous that will block both. They will not care if it's an MAOA or an MAOB enzyme. Then to make your life a little more complicated, because as students it's not complicated enough, we have a variety of duration of length of the effect of these blockers. Turns out there's only one small category of drugs that are reversible blockers. All the rest of them are irreversible. It means once they've shut down that enzyme, you've got to generate new enzyme before you can degrade these transmitters again. All right, given all those permutations, now let's go through the chart. We have reversible MAOA inhibitors. And the one that would probably be best to learn is this one, befloxetone. Befloxetone. It's a reversible MAOA inhibitor, so it would reversibly prevent breakdown of norepinephrine and serotonin. If you wanted to prevent the breakdown of those same neurotransmitters, but do it on a semi-permanent basis, you would use a drug like Harmaline. Harmaline. It's an irreversible MAOA inhibitor. If you were interested in blocking degradation of those transmitters and you didn't care that you also prevented degradation of other ones, you could use the more nonspecific drug, iproniazid. Iproniazid. It will prevent breakdown of MAOA or MAOB pathways. Finally, if you wanted a specific drug for preventing the activity of MAOBs, you don't have a choice of reversible or non-reversible. You've only got the irreversible form. And the drug relevant to learn there is Deprenyl. Deprenyl. Deprenyl, in fact, is beginning to be fairly widely prescribed as a new treatment for Alzheimer's disease. And what was the old standby treatment for Alzheimer's? Amantine before that. An anticholinesterase, if you recall. Okay. Based on a whole long series of papers saying that you had low acetylcholine in Alzheimer's patients. Well, the fact that Deprenyl is actually showing clinical benefits suggests that you've also got impairments in levels of dopamine and histamine as well. In fact, Alzheimer's appears to impact every transmitter system. And in fact, the neurons that get wiped out initially in Alzheimer's are glutamate neurons. Pyramidal neurons, not cholinergic ones, not dopaminergic, not histaminergic, but they're influenced by all these other transmitter systems. All right, so that's the rather complicated chart for MAO inhibitors, but really only four different drugs to learn, two of which affect MAOAs, one is reversible, one's not. One that affects either A's or B's, irreversible. One that affects only B's, irreversible. Then we've got the other degradation enzyme, COMT. Turns out it's used for degrading all of these biogenic amines, but particularly focused on the catecholamines. Most of its efficacy is on catecholamines, COMTs.
I'm sorry, could you remind me what A-specific and B-specific, what does A do for
you? Right here.
Just the kinds of...
The specific transmitters they break down. A's for those two, B's for the ones that have A's in them.
Are those arbitrary categories that psychiatrists came up with, A and B? Or?
They had the names before they knew what they did. Or else they probably have named them in the other order. Yes?
Do you know if one of those is MSAM?
Is MSAM?
Maybe Seligiline?
I think it is Seligiline. Yeah. But you can look it up. For a COMT inhibitor, it's irreversible. The drug that would be useful to learn is Talcapone. If we were in Chicago, they'd have probably named it Al Capone. Talcapone. And they probably would have called him that even though he was really short. Tall Capone. In fact, if you notice, a lot of them have that Capone suffix on it. Maybe one of his nephews owns the company. A cautionary note that's often included if somebody has a prescription for these drugs is not to ingest any of these foods at the bottom. Red wines, strongly aged cheeses, or turkey legs, because they all contain lots of the amino acid precursors that are used to generate those neurotransmitters. If you're going to have lots of extra transmitter around, you don't want to suddenly be generating whole lots more. You could run into troubles by totally unregulated levels of neurotransmitter. Okay, so that's packaging and degradation and transporters we talked about. We still need to talk about receptors. So let's look at the simplified version of the receptors first. They're what are called adrenoreceptors. They're usually thought of as receptors for norepinephrine. That's not technically true. In the periphery of the body, there are receptors for at least norepinephrine and epinephrine. We divide them up into alpha receptors and beta receptors. The first two letters of the Greek alphabet, alpha and beta. Now, anybody from your readings know which of these also responds to dopamine? If there was a pop quiz today, everybody would get a zero. Is it beta? Nope. So you'd have negative 50 for today. Alpha 2? Nope. You'd have negative 50 for today, too.
Ooh, alpha 1.
Alpha 1s. Alpha 1 also will respond to dopamine. So they're not even just norepinephrine and epinephrine receptors. Hope she doesn't die. That's pretty bad. Okay. Norepinephrine, as it turns out, as a metabotropic neurotransmitter, covers the full gamut of classes, or at least the families, of G proteins. So alpha 1s are mediated by GQ alpha subunits. Alpha 2s by GIs. Betas by GSs. Okay, so which of those then have anything to do with levels of IP3, which class of norepinephrine receptors? The first one, the alpha 1s. Which ones would decrease pKa activity? Alpha 2s. Which ones would increase levels of cyclic AMP? Betas. Okay, notice I'm asking you different questions about second messenger systems. You should be able to answer questions either at the receptor level, the G protein level, the target of those G proteins, or things downstream from those G proteins. All of the above. Should be second nature, those second messenger cascades by now. And if it's not, when are the review sessions coming up?
Saturday.
One on Saturday. And then there's also some early next week as well. But then again, it should all be in your notes by now. And I know it's all in notes that are posted up on e-learning. Okay. Everything about second messengers. We've talked about it lots and lots and lots of times, and you're going to need to know it. You're going to need to know it. Those of you that keep raising your hands and want to go to medical or dental school or graduate school, you need to know it for the rest of your life. So if you don't know it now, this weekend would be the right time to make sure you do know it. Okay? All right, if you notice, these have a lot of peripheral effects. They're involved in things related to smooth muscle contraction, related to release of the neurotransmitter itself. And they, in fact, have effects on heart muscle as well. Now, I'm not going to expect you to learn all of the cardiac physiology that's go around. But again, those of you that think you're going on for advanced training, expect to learn that and a lot more. All right, now I'm going to show you the complicated version of it, but I don't expect you to learn the complicated version. I expect you to learn drugs that fit the simpler model, with one or two exceptions. For alpha-1 receptors, which again are tied to GQs, we now divide them up into three different categories. Notice again, pharmacologists are impaired in their knowledge of the alphabet. Alpha-1As, alpha-1Bs, and alpha-1Ds. See, to be a pharmacologist, you didn't have to get a good grade in kindergarten. A's, B's, and D's. We used to include a C, but that turned out not to be an alpha-1 receptor at all. Receptor for a completely different class. So alpha-1 A's, B's, and D's. They're differentially distributed. Only the first and last are in this nervous system. Others are distributed throughout the body. Don't expect you to learn all those different categories. Just know that there's multiple ones. As I mentioned earlier, and eventually people guess because they guessed the first two wrong, alpha ones are also stimulated or agonized by dopamine, not just norepinephrine and epinephrine. So alpha ones are a true catecholamine agonized receptor. Doesn't matter which of the catecholamines. Of course, all the catecholamines are endogenous agonists. Which one, though, is not a nervous system endogenous agonist? Epinephrine. Okay. Then we have a drug that's fairly specific just for the alpha ones. Phenylephrine. If you read the list of ingredients on an awful lot of decongestants, you're likely to see that drug listed. Phenylephrine. There's another drug right below it, and believe it or not, that's in color, although our projector doesn't manage to make that in color. Ephedrine. Sometimes mispronounced ephedrine. But ephedrine, there's a synthetic form of that. Anybody know what that drug is? Sudafed or pseudoephedrine. Chemically very similar. Okay. It's a full agonist for these alpha-1 receptors. And again, you often find those drugs in decongestants. That used to be a very easy drug to obtain. Why is it not any longer? It can be readily used in some recipes that are on the internet for synthesis of methamphetamine. I wouldn't suggest following one of those recipes. They not only do they create an illegal compound, but they also produce a lot of vapor that's easy to smell and makes it really easy to tell that you're running a meth lab. It also permeates whatever building it's done in so that the building really isn't habitable afterwards. Of course, people running meth labs don't often care about that, particularly if they're consuming lots of the product themselves. There are lots of other drugs in that category, but that's plenty to learn. There's one other one that is actually fairly specific. I don't want you to learn the specificity, but it's one that you might use. Tetrahydrazoline. Anyone ever use that drug? It's in an awful lot of eye drops. It's an active ingredient in things like Visine that gets the red out. Okay. Dilates the blood vessels. Then we have antagonists. I'm not going to bother having you learn specific antagonists, although just keep in mind this drug is showing up again. That one that was sort of promiscuous, didn't care what it bound to. Let's look at antagonists with some degree of specificity or lack of specificity. These first two drugs, phentolamine and prazosin, are antagonists for alpha receptors. Phentolamine and prazosin for alpha 1s or alpha 2s. One that's been used the longest is phentolamine. It's an incredibly potent drug. So more commonly these days, prazosin is used. Prazosin. If you wanted one that was specific just for the alpha 1s, not for alpha 2s, you would use a drug like corianthine. If you wanted a suicide antagonist for these alphas, phenoxybenzamine. So how long would the duration of phenoxybenzamine be? Longer than the duration of the presence of that protein. Suicide antagonist. Okay, again, let's look at some clinical uses. We have ones for stuffy nose, various other symptoms of that sort. They're found in nasal sprays and tablets, major ingredient in concoctions that you drink to render yourself unconscious overnight if you've got a cold. Things like ephedrine, pseudoephedrine, phenylephrine. Then you've got things that are in various things to put into your eyes so it doesn't look like you've been using other drugs, perhaps. Tetrahydrazoline. Or maybe you were just out in the wind too much. And there are plenty of other drugs in these same categories. I don't think you would probably get a prescription for norepinephrine. Some people might have a prescription for epinephrine, though, but not typically so that you could make your nose stop running. Instead, it's in case you have an extremely severe allergic reaction so that you might actually survive the next 5 or 10 minutes afterwards. Okay. All right, again, complicated story versus the simplified one. For alpha 2 receptors, we divide them into three different categories. And here at least the alphabet was remembered. That's alpha 2 A's, B's, and C's. Turns out all three types are expressed in the nervous system with some differential expression, of course. The only one that's really relevant to remember that subcategory, alpha 2A's, because those are the autoreceptors for norepinephrine. Alpha 2A's. Okay. And the autoreceptor effect, again, and we've looked at this plenty of times, is mediated not by the alpha subunits, but by the beta gamma subunits. In the case of the alpha 2As, it's the beta subunit effect presynaptically downregulating voltage dependent calcium channels. And if you have less calcium influx, as you keep seeing more and more norepinephrine, the neuron releases less and less norepinephrine, the autoreceptor effect. Okay. Now again, they respond to catecholamines. That's why they're called adrenoreceptors, but in this case, not dopamine, just norepinephrine and epinephrine. No effect of dopamine on alpha 2s. If you want an alpha 2 specific agonist, you'd give a drug like clonidine. And clonidine is widely used in clinical practice for people that have things like heart failure, problems with too low a blood pressure. Clonidine. For these autoreceptors, we have another small group of drugs. The first one we talked about previously, ephedrine, is a partial agonist for alpha 2s. Another one that you're never going to get in an over-the-counter drug, lysergic acid diethylamide, or LSD. It's a partial agonist for alpha 2A receptors. It does not typically explain the hallucinogenic properties of LSD, but it does explain some of the side effects, things like dry mouth, rapid heartbeat, various other side effects that are notable. I don't expect you to learn any specific antagonists for these three different categories, but instead, again, the more generic antagonists, phentolamine and prazosin. Again, those affected alpha 1s as well, phentolamine and prazosin. And a drug that blocks alpha 2s specifically, yohimbine. Okay. And what was the G protein involved? GIs. So what would that do to PKC activity? None of the above. Now PKC, what would be the PK affected by these? PKA, the cyclic AMP-dependent protein kinase. GIs inhibit AC, adenylate cyclase. They've all got that letter A in it, except for the I. Would have been nice if they'd called them GAs. But they thought I for inhibitory was sufficient. First pharmacology class that I actually ever took was from the guy that gave those their name. GI and GS and GQ and so on. He discovered them as a graduate student. All right. Uses of these drugs. Phentolamine and prazosin are very widely marketed as vasodilators to lower blood pressure, increase blood flow. Not surprisingly, they can be an alternative to the drug that this guy markets on television all the time, with the side effect that they have to be directly injected into the organ to have their effect. In the case of erectile dysfunction treatments, what organ would they have to be injected into?
You just
want to
hear someone say that.
Penis.
The penis. not probably a treatment most people would volunteer for. Well, unless they're also into S&M. But they do increase blood flow. I'd be willing to bet that now that no one will forget that these increase blood flow. All right. Many of these drugs fall within the category that we call phenylethylamines. Phenylethylamines. And many of the phenylethylamines are hallucinogenic drugs. In fact, there's good evidence that norepinephrine itself helps create hallucinogenic effects in the nervous system. Distorts our view of reality. When you're under stress, the world looks different than when you're not. If you look at the sort of stick man view of the molecular structure of norepinephrine, looks like it's got two legs here, a body, and one funny looking arm. Turns out the more that stick structure is modified so that it looks sort of like a warrior with a shield and a sword, the more potent the hallucinogenic properties. So this one, mescaline, comes from this plant that actually grows in West Texas and further south from the border. Very potent hallucinogen. Acts on alpha-2 receptors, but also on other types of receptors. Elemicin. Believe it or not, you probably have that compound in your kitchen. Elemicin. I know what that's found in? Nutmeg. I'm not going to tell you the quantity of nutmeg that's necessary to have these effects. Suffice it to say, it takes more than one container. Many more. And if you can ingest that much, you're a pretty sad person. Most people would puke long before that. Of course, we've mentioned MDMA or ecstasy before. Somewhat similar structure. This drug, caffeine, is a derivative of a plant compound, cathinone, and it's widely used, particularly in Africa. It's been used for thousands of years as a hallucinogenic drug. Caffeine, not the stuff that you buy in coffee and sodas. And in fact, ephedrine, which again comes from a plant material. Then we mentioned the antagonist drug, gohembine. Also has some hallucinogenic properties. Can't see it with this projector in this room. It comes from a plant bark. It's believed that since these have partial agonist properties, as partial agonists, they're actually blocking some of the effects of the full agonists. They're competing for the same site. So that may be why the actual antagonists share some similar properties by blocking that agonist site. The story, of course, is much more complicated, and we'll talk more about it when we talk about serotonin. But we know much of what goes on in our brains is not just straight normal neurotransmitter processing, but lots of modulation and lots of sort of playing with the truth. We don't really see the outside world in its real state most of the time. We take this drug we talked about previously, LSD. Please don't take it in class, at least. In fact, don't take it in the state of Texas. It's illegal. But if we talk about the drug LSD, it turns out not only to bind to the alpha-2A receptors, but it binds very strongly to certain classes of serotonin receptors. Additionally, it binds to the D2 category of dopamine receptors. Well, what were D2 receptors associated with? What do you take neuroleptic drugs to block? D2, psychoses. So if you partially agonize those, you can induce states that are similar to psychosis. So called psychomimetic effects. Okay. And literally, we have a sort of a divide in the scientific community and in the community that was influenced by scientists on whether these drugs are good things or bad things. Lysergic acid was originally developed by a Swiss chemist who was looking for blood pressure treatments. Turned out not to be very effective as a blood pressure treatment, but when a little bit of it spilled on a counter and he accidentally got it on his finger and accidentally stuck his finger in his mouth, he had the weirdest bicycle trip home that he had ever had in his life. Afterwards, he thought maybe he was dying. When he woke up the next day and he hadn't died, he went back to the lab and licked that counter again. His explanation was he was a scientist and he had to repeat the experiment. The earliest uses of compounds like this was by psychiatrists for treatment of various disorders. In fact, the most beneficial effect that was found was for treatment of alcoholism. Do we have any problem with alcoholism in the U.S. or anywhere else in the world?
No,
certainly not. What's the primary treatment for alcoholism? Either AA or abstinence, which equals the same thing.
What about naltrexone?
What about naltrexone? Not very effective for alcoholism. That's a blocker for opiates.
I thought it was supposed to help with
No, not so much. How high a percentage of people actually successfully stay in AA? Anybody know? AA won't tell you. It's anonymous. So they claim they don't keep track. But people have enrolled AA members independently in studies. And it looks like long-term, it's somewhere between 10 and 15% stay abstinent for long periods of time. 85%, in other words, or better, fail. That's not a high success rate. Treatment with LSD for 2 consecutive days was yielding long-term results of 80 to 85% positive success. Pardon? Well, the psychiatrist claimed that they were changing the mindset of the people. We don't really know because this sort of work isn't going on any longer. It has started back up within the last 4 or 5 years in Switzerland, which is where the drug was originally developed by Sandoz. But elsewhere in the world, it's still very much frowned upon. In fact, the other drug that I had in this corner here, MDMA, was being similarly used. And that now is illegal as well. So we're going to talk about drug laws later in the semester and about whether the categorization of them makes any rational sense. Because one of the rationale for making drugs illegal is supposed to be that they have no medical uses. But they put one extra word in there, no acceptable medical use.
Acceptable to who?
Well, that's the question. These days, I guess it would be acceptable to the Tea Party. Right. Yes.
Is LSD the drug that causes flashbacks?
That causes flashbacks. Well, that's a controversial question as well. Okay. There is some literature that says yes. Okay. And maybe that might be a part of the explanation for the effects long term. Probably not, though. All right, let's go on to beta receptors. We'll come back to issues like that next time when we talk about serotonin. So it turns out most of those effects are mediated by serotonin receptors. Beta receptors, it's going to be necessary to learn more than one type. We now have 3 types of beta receptors, beta 1s, 2s, and 3s. For our purposes, we can largely ignore beta-3s because there aren't any clinically relevant drugs at this point in time. But beta-1s and beta-2s, we need to know the difference between. They're all found in neurons. They're all found in similar tissues. One of the major differences is that beta-2s are also in lung tissue. So what category of patients might be influenced by beta-2s?
Asthmatics,
people with asthma, breathing problems. Again, they're affected by norepinephrine and epinephrine as agonists. So those are the endogenous agonists, no effective dopamine. They're also affected by ephedrine, which was an agonist for alpha-1s, but only a partial agonist for alpha-2s. It's a full agonist, again, for betas. If you want a specific agonist for the beta receptors, you can use a drug like isoproterenol. Isoproterenol as a beta agonist. Now I want you to look at this suffix, terol, terol. The drug has a terol suffix, it's a beta agonist. If it has an olol suffix, it's a beta antagonist. Terol agonist, olol antagonist. Zamotarol, XAM, Adderall, is a beta 1 agonist. You might take that for heart effects or pressor effects, but these drugs are much more widely prescribed. Beta 2 agonists. Albuterol, anybody know what that's prescribed in? Those asthma inhalers, ones that give a puff. They're also called acute inhalers, where someone's having an asthma attack and their bronchial tubes have shut down and they can't breathe right then. Albuterol. Most asthmatics also typically every day or sometimes a couple times a day take a drug like salmeterol. That very often is inhalable too, more typically in an inhalable powder. And that's what's considered their maintenance drug to keep their asthma relieved. Salmeterol. Which would you think would be a longer acting drug of the two? Salmeterol. Albuterol is a very short-acting drug. Since these also have cardiac effects, there's danger of overdose on drugs like that. People having asthma attacks that keep pumping their inhaler could have a heart attack. People that forget how many puffs they took of their long-acting asthma medication, took 3 or 4 puffs instead of 1, might have a heart attack or a stroke. They're necessary drugs for the treatment of asthma, but their therapeutic index is not very high. Remember we talked about therapeutic index early in the semester? Okay. It means the LD50 is really close to the ED50. More commonly for the beta-1s, more prescriptions are written not for the agonists, but for antagonists. Drugs like atenolol, a beta blocker, a beta antagonist, a beta-1 antagonist. What would those kind of drugs be used for? cardiac problems perhaps, but more widely as antihypertensive drugs to lower blood pressure. Atenolol. In fact, any of them that have that olol probably used as a blood pressure medication. If you don't care about avoiding effects on the lungs, you could give a more generic drug. Propranolol. That'd be okay for most people. What patient population would you not give propranolol to? Asthmatics. That would be a bad drug to give to an asthmatic. Because they're having enough trouble breathing. But propranolol is still widely used as a blood pressure med. It's an old drug. Okay. Again, what would beta agonists do to CAM kinase activity? Nothing. What do beta agonists work through? What G protein? GSs. So what's the cell membrane enzyme that's affected by that? Adenylate cyclase. What does it produce? Cyclic AMP. What kinase is cyclic AMP dependent? PKA. Not PKC, not CAM kinase. Any permutation of those kinds of questions should be easy by now. If it's not easy to you and I'm not getting good answers right now, that's a bad sign. Exam's only a week away from Tuesday. So you've got a lot of catch up to do, it sounds like. Maybe you're just shy in class. I know better than that. But you should be able to answer those kinds of questions very easily. Okay. Oh, we've mentioned dimerism before. Turns out that most all of these norepinephrine receptors are homodimeric. What does that mean?
Two of the same.
Two of the same. Okay. We've seen that kind of story before. It's not even known if they're obligate homodimers. They have to exist that way to function. Pretty much all of them do, though. In the homodimeric form, they typically only bind one norepinephrine molecule. But there's some evidence that some of them give you twice as much G protein activity. Again, what's probably the biggest category of use of norepinephrine-related drugs? Things related to the cardiovascular system. Okay, either affects directly on the heart or on blood vessels. Norepinephrine, when it's released from the sympathetic nervous system, increases the heart beat, each beat of the heart, each action potential that causes the contraction of the heart is stronger. You actually have an increase in calcium conductances underlying that heartbeat and a stronger pulse. More blood volume is pumped per stroke of the heart. It also speeds up the heart rate. And that's mediated by an effect on T-type calcium currents, low voltage activated currents. So it stimulates both high and low voltage activated currents in cardiac muscle. Faster heart rate, stronger heartbeat means more blood pumping to all the organs. That's a good thing if you're trying to run away or fight or do something. It's a bad thing if you're bleeding. You think there's ever any sympathetic activation if somebody's in a car wreck? And unfortunately, that means they bleed out that much faster. So EMTs need to be on the spot even quicker and know what to do and how to triage people successfully. I think I'll spare you all the intricacies of the rest of the effects on the cardiovascular system. But again, if you're going on to medical school or dental school or even graduate school, expect to learn a lot more about it. We mentioned the difference that some patients get treated with antagonists, some with agonists. When they're being treated with beta blockers, they're usually treated with a beta-1 specific blocker, a beta-1 antagonist, like the drug atenolol, so that they can lower their blood pressure, dilate the blood vessels. The smaller the volume of the blood vessel, the higher the pressure. So dilating it lowers it. Simple physics. If people are having trouble with asthma, though, you don't want to give an antagonist, particularly not a beta-2 antagonist. You want a beta-2 agonist so that they can continue to breathe. So albuterol, drug most commonly found in the quick-acting inhalers, and drugs like salmeterol, and the ones for longer duration effects. And there are lots and lots of other drugs in that category. In fact, in those long-duration inhalers, people often take another category of drugs besides a beta-2 agonist. You may know what category of drugs that would be. Think baseball or football or weightlifting.
Steroids.
Okay. So I knew that would answer that question these days. Shouldn't, but it does. I'll often take an inhalable steroid as well to prevent inflammation in the lungs. Okay. All right. More than enough for the day, I think.